Hey everybody, it's Daniel. Welcome back to Spain to Go, the best podcast in the entire multiverse for all things Spain. I'm here today with Felicity Hughes, who writes one of my favorite blogs about Madrid, The Making of Madrid, at themakingofmadrid.com. Gives a lot of interesting historical detail about places in Madrid you may not have thought much about, and historical moments that are a bit less commonly talked about. Well, Felicity, welcome to the show.
Hello, thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Let's start with a quick and easy question. Maybe quick, definitely easier. Who are you, where are you from, and what brought you to Madrid?
Well, I'm from the UK. And while I was there, I married a Spanish guy. We didn't actually live in Madrid. Initially, we moved to Japan. I lived there for 6 years. And then we came back here. The idea was just to stay here for a really short period of time. But we both ended up loving it. And so we permanently settled here now.
All right. What part of the UK are you from, in case we've got UK people listening?
I'm sort of from all over, so it's difficult to pin down. But I generally say Brighton, because that's where I lived most of my adult life there.
Brighton. Okay. And what do you love about Madrid?
I think the thing I love about Madrid is its inclusivity. So I've been writing the Lonely Planet Guide to Madrid at the moment. I had to write a piece about Meet the Madrileños, and I tried to find a gata, which is a person whose both grandparents are from Madrid. And it was almost impossible to find someone like that, because Madrid has a huge influx of people in the 60s. A lot of people left after the Civil War as well. But this means that everybody from Madrid accepts you almost immediately. So you only need to be living in the city for a very short period of time for them to consider you a Madrileño, even if you're a foreigner. So that's the wonderful thing about Madrid. There's no sort of great sense of us against them. Everybody's a Madrileño.
This is exactly the problem I have with Catalonia, because the Catalans, you know, for better or for worse, it's like this ethnic linguistic group that I'm not a part of. Mm. So just moving here, living here, etc., does nothing to make me more Catalan. And I guess there's no path to becoming Catalan, as it were. And I do remember living in Madrid that it's very sort of accepting that if you're living there, you are Madrileño, and no further questions, really.
Yeah, it's why I left Japan. I spoke Japanese. Worked as a journalist there, and I would constantly sort of get people giving me rounds of applause if I spoke Japanese. And after a while, it grates on you a little bit, no matter how well intentioned. There's always the sense that you're the foreigner and you'll never integrate.
Speaking of ethnic and linguistic groups that are not accepting new members. The Japanese are, you know, on the top of that list, I think. All right. Well, you have a new book out. What would you like to say?
I have it here.
Oh, you have a copy of the new book.
Oh, can you see that?
So it's a guide to Madrid's literary district, Guía del Barrio de las Letras. Well, why don't you just tell us a little bit about the book first off?
Right. So this project started just after the pandemic. I met David Price, who opened a bookshop in Barrio de las Letras, but it wasn't open at the time. And he's a big fan of my blog. And he was like, I want to do a book with you about Barrio de las Letras. And he'd never done a book before, so it was a big learning curve for him. But we took it slowly so we could do the best job possible. Once I wrote it, he had the great idea of translating it into Spanish. So there's parallel texts, which is fantastic for people learning Spanish. I mean, I've used these kind of books myself, and if it's a subject you're interested in, it makes a learning experience much more fascinating, really. We also got great photographs by John Dapolito, and amazing illustrations by this guy called, well, his Instagram handle is Madrid Giri. I don't know if you know him.
I do not. Madrid Giri.
Yes, and he's called Nathan Brenville, and he did a portrait of figurehead for each chapter. So that was my idea, that we had a writer who would be the figurehead for each chapter. It begins, of course, with Cervantes, but we also have Hemingway. And the last figurehead we had was a woman, because I felt very strongly it should be a woman. But it's also possibly Madrid's most famous contemporary writer, who's Alma de Negrandes. She just died, and there's a monument, well, sort of her name up in lights, let's say, in Atocha Station, which has been renamed Atocha Alma de Negrandes. Not many
Yeah.
people know that,
It's there. It's Madrid Atocha Almudena Grandes is the
yes.
name of the station. They like to just add extra people to the end of places. Here we have Aeropuerto de Barcelona El Prat, Josep Tarradellas, I believe, is
Yeah.
the full thing. And Madrid Barajas Adolfo Suarez. Like
Yes.
that, this kind of thing. So, did all of these writers have a relationship with Barrio de las Letras? Why don't you explain why Barrio de las Letras is called Barrio de las Letras? Because I don't think of it as that. I think of it as, Calle Huertas and the surrounding area.
Yeah, it's also called Huertas, and
Yeah, I haven't
Huertas.
paid much attention to this because it's been kind of touristy, and I don't know, not on my top 10 list really, but please explain letras to us.
Yeah, so Huertas, the name Huertas is a good place to start, because you know what that means, right? It's
It's like an
kitchen garden.
orchard.
Yeah, it's like a kitchen garden. So it was initially outside of the main city walls of Madrid, but when the walls were sort of widened and Felipe II sort of landed in Madrid and chose it as the capital, it became more important. But before that, it was a sort of rural area. And then he established the theatre was very popular. So they would go on in like the corrales, which are these traditional houses built around a courtyard. But Madrid never had an official theatre until they built a corrala, which is now the Teatro Español. Do you know that in Plaza Santa Ana? And that was built around the same time as the Globe in London. So this suddenly became a literary district, but it was also disreputable. So there was a saying that was, Calle de las Huertas. Ah, no, sorry. Huertas is más putas que That's it. Barrio de Huertas, más putas que puertas. So
Barrio de Huertas más putas que puertas.
that's more whores than doors. So
Okay.
it
All right. It does
was.
rhyme in English also.
So
Okay. I
it
hadn't
was
heard that one.
also. Yeah, it was the theater was sort of disreputable, so people like Cervantes and Lope de Vega lived there at the time. I guess it was a lot cheaper than living in central Madrid, where, but yeah, from that point onwards, it became the literary district. And then because this theater remained there the whole time and had various different incarnations, it was always sort of this center of theater and literature. and lots of famous writers have passed through, not only Spanish, but of course, most famously is Hemingway, that he spent a lot of time here during the Civil War and after.
Yeah, he mentions that, what, Carrer de San Jerónimo in one of his stories, whatever the first story in the big classic Hemingway compilation, is about a, hostel on Carrer de San Jerónimo. So that goes right through what I consider to be Huertas from Sol.
And yeah, of course, he loved drinking. So you have
Of course.
all these bars that have associations with Hemingway.
Yeah, why don't you tell us about the Hemingway bars for a moment? I don't drink anymore, but we can talk about, Hemingway.
Yeah, well, of course, he loved to drink, and it was a very stressful situation during the Civil War. He was working as a correspondent out in the Telefonica building, and that building was being continuously shelled. So no wonder he wanted to be drink because it was very stressful. They had to run out from the building, and the first place they'd hit, dodging the shells along Gran Vía, would be Chicotes, Museo de Chicotes, which is just outside of Barrio de las Letras. And that's where all the press liked to hang out and share stories. But then there were other places that he would go to, like, let me just make sure I've got this name right, La Venezia. Oh, yeah, hold on, I've
Valencia,
got to.
yeah, I remember that place.
Venezia, yes, Venezia. It was founded, I think, in the 20s, a sherry bar, but at the time, like, sherry was the working man's drink. So the people who were running it were very much supportive of the Republican side, and all the Republican fighters would go and drink there. But you would also have spies on the nationalist side. So they told you, like, you can't take a photograph within the bar. And that rule, like, stands to this day. So anyone trying to get their phone out gets told off. But at the time, it was so nationalist spies couldn't, like, kind of leak information. But the whole place was, full of gossip. So Hemingway was drawn there. He also liked, let's find this, Tablao Flamenco Via Rosa.
Is that place still there? I thought they closed that for a little bit.
It's under a new management, but it's still one of the most famous tablaos of flamenco, and it's got this gorgeous tiled exterior. Have you? I mean, you can see it on Plaza Santa Ana.
Yeah, I only know the exterior. I have never been super into flamenco, and I haven't been inside, but yeah, it's right on the corner of Plaza Santa Ana, notable for its tiled exterior, yeah.
Yeah, and so he would drink there, as would Arturo Barea, whose trilogy about the Spanish Civil War is absolutely incredible. It's called The Forging of a Rebel.
The Forging of a Rebel, is
Yeah.
this, did he write it in English or in Spanish?
So this is interesting because he wrote it in Spanish, but his wife was a professional translator and they couldn't have it published in Spain. It was written after the Civil War. It was banned in Spain.
Yeah.
So the first version came out in English and she was had a lot of literary talent, so it reads very well in English. And then they lost the original Spanish, so it had to be retranslated back into Spanish when it got published in South America. And people say the English version's better. So it's actually one of those few times where, you're better off reading the English version.
And it's a trilogy.
Yes,
All right.
yes.
I've done a lot of reading about the Civil War, but trilogies are a bit intimidating.
I would say if you're interested in particularly the Civil War, read the third one, because that's the one all about the Civil War. And he mentions Hemingway a little bit in there. They were not friends because he was the censor and Hemingway was trying to get his stories past the censor. Of course, Barea had to censor these pieces because he didn't want to give away important strategic information to the other side. So they were sort of at odds with each other.
Hemingway is a whole thing if you're, I don't know, a male American writer in Spain. People are always like, oh, yeah, just like Hemingway. And I've never been like a Hemingway super fan, but he's definitely had a big impact on, Spain, as far as that goes. And there's
Yes.
places in Barcelona also that, claim that Hemingway used to hang out there, and I don't know.
I have mixed feelings about him. I think the same as Barea did. I think he's a fantastic writer. Like there's very spare, direct prose. Anything Hemingway writes about writing is always great advice. But in terms of the Civil War, he was a little bit of a tourist. He was older then. He was the same age as Barea, more or less in his late 30s. But yeah, he wasn't so much as a participant. His lover at the time was Martha Gellhorn, who was much younger than him. He was married, but they had a mad, passionate affair in Madrid. And her reports are much better. She was paid peanuts, but people are like, her reports on the Spanish Civil War are the ones to read because she actually went down to the front lines. And I mean, he did too, but he was in a very comfortable situation in a luxury hotel.
I read a couple of his like columns that he was publishing from the Civil War, and just I found a list of them online and I picked a couple at random, and I didn't get anything out of it that I hadn't, didn't do anything for me. I'll check out Gellhorn. I think there's maybe HBO movie or something about Hemingway and Gellhorn in Madrid that I saw several years ago.
Oh, okay, sorry, that wasn't on my radar. I'll have to check it
Something
out.
like that. I definitely saw, now that you mention it, Gellhorn, I definitely saw some movie about their romance, etc. But
Well,
that.
the other thing about Hemingway is he loved bullfighting, and the people who were sort of the bullfighting crowd that he'd met before the war, they tended to be on the right wing, as is still the case. I think that I mean, it's a big generalization, but it's got a lot to do with sort of ultra-nationalism and whatever. So he wasn't really aware of these nuances and was still sort of keen to hang out with these sort of macho bullfighting scene that wasn't so popular with people like Barea. So,
Yeah, I know that bullfighting is kind of right wing now. I also had the impression that in the past it was less so, but it might have still had that tendency.
Yeah, I think it did, for sure.
The like Orwell, Orwell mentions it in his book that there's in Barcelona there's no bullfights scheduled for when he's there, because for some reason, all of the good bullfighters are fascists, I think he says. So I don't think he was either aware of the, Spanish, well, thing around bullfighting. It's a whole thing here in Spain, but he did figure out that the better bullfighters were right wing, and that could have something to do with why it was not popular during the Civil War, or in parts of the country that were going left. Great. So that's a few places to see in Letras, the Hemingway bars. What else do we have, if I
Oh,
may?
there are even more Hemingway bars.
Even
I
more
didn't get
Hemingway bars.
to.
What if we
He was
wanted to
everywhere.
see something more historical? Do we have that also?
Yes, there's an organization called Ateneo, which was formed in the late 19th century. I don't know if you know that Ferdinand the Seventh was a pretty brutal ruler. He closed down the free press, and a lot of liberal writers and thinkers who wanted to sort of modernize Spain had to flee to London, where they formed a little group, and then eventually they were able to come back to Madrid, and they formed this place called Ateneo. And it's a little bit like a TARDIS. It's got this amazing facade. But if you go in the building, it's a very narrow facade, but the building goes back a really long way. And it's got a beautiful old library. You can ask for permission to go in and see that. And it's also got this gorgeous Salon de Actos, which is almost like an Art Deco, beautiful ceiling with gold inlay. It's absolutely stunning, and it's something that not a lot of people know exists in Barrio de las Letras. But they do put on events, and especially around this time, Dia del Libro, they'll definitely have some talks on that are open to the public.
Great. Yeah, I've
Oh.
seen that building, but I'm not, I wasn't aware you could just go in. What else? What else do you have?
Well, there's also Casa Lope de Vega. So, a contemporary of Cervantes was Lope de Vega. Cervantes must have slightly hated this guy because he was 15 years younger than him. He was incredibly popular in his lifetime. He produced lots and lots of plays. He had tons of lovers. Cervantes wasn't really a success until his late 50s when Don Quixote came out. He was almost 60. But Lope de Vega was, I suppose, more of a public figure in his time, more successful. So his house still exists. Cervantes's house got knocked down. But Lope de Vega's house is on Calle Cervantes, and
Oh, dreadful.
Cervantes's bones are in the convent of Trinitarios. And that is Calle Lope de Vega.
There we go. I was wondering about the bones, because I remember hearing the story that years ago, some nuns down in this area had, some big box of bones, some of which were potentially from Cervantes. Have they actually finished that investigation and decided, like, this is Cervantes's skeleton here?
Well, Cervantes doesn't have any surviving descendants, so they weren't able to work out which of those bones were him. So there is a box of bones with his initials on them, but there are bones from women in there, so it's a big mess, so they don't really know.
Okay, but potentially Cervantes's bones are in this
Yes.
monastery. Okay. And is that also open to the public,
In
sort of?
theory, yes, but in practice, it's quite difficult to get in. You can only go in on a Sunday at certain hours and call in advance, and people have been turned away.
Okay.
The nuns are cloistered nuns. Like, there are many cloistered nuns in Madrid, and they don't particularly like having a lot of contact with the outside world.
Yeah.
Look, Lope de Vega's daughter was also a cloistered nun in that convent, and she was a writer herself. She wrote plays, and she appeared in her father's plays. But part of the reason why she was in the convent was she was an illegitimate child, and these
Yeah.
kind of he loved her. He was very nice to her. But, she was inconvenient, so
Yeah.
she would live a life in the convent. Quite a comfortable life. She became like the abbess, but yes, it's
Lope de Vega's daughter. All right. Well, talking about wacky tourist attractions, then, I hear you give tours of Madrid.
Yes, I do. Yeah.
What's the sort of idea or philosophy behind these tours?
Well, I started doing them with a tour of Lavapiés. At the time, there were no tours of Lavapiés in English. And I felt that there was an interesting story to be told about that barrio because history is often told from the perspective of the kings. but you can tell another story from the perspective of a city's working class population. And Lavapiés is really interesting from that point of view. I've since expanded to do tours of the sort of major sites, but I like to give, so I say, you know, it's Madrid off the beaten path, but it's also sort of, I try and go a little bit deeper than your average tour guide, and I talk about things that perhaps a little bit lesser known about the city.
Yeah, that's what I love about your blog. So I'm sure the tours are also worth the time and money. It's these are available on your blog, or how does one sign up if one wants to go on a tour?
You just get in touch with me. I have to admit that I've had to stop giving tours for a very brief period because I've been writing the new Lonely Planet guide to Madrid and the whole thing has been rewritten. So, as you can imagine, like, it's a huge task. I'm just coming to the end of that now, so I will be available again. But yeah. Yeah, just
Yeah.
get in contact with me.
Lonely Planets. Like, I was doing their Madrid website or something several years ago. When I got tired of Lonely Planet, I passed it off to my friend Cassandra. I don't know, how did they find you? Through the blog or?
Well, they found me because I published an article about with them that just happened to I sort of hit on a very timely event. Do you know about the cathedral that's made out of rubbish?
The cathedral that's made out of rubbish in some town south of Madrid. Yeah, I've heard about this.
Yeah, so I went out during the pandemic on my bike, and my husband's a photographer. We took lots of photos, we talked to the people there. It was totally empty. And I'm just trying to get the piece up. Oh, where is it? Because I've forgotten the name of the, where it's something del Campo. Where it is.
Is it mejorada?
Could be. So it's the Cathedral of Justo Gallego. And this was a guy who was a monk, but he got kicked out for some reason. But he was, oh no, sorry, he was terribly ill, so he couldn't continue being a monk. His family had a lot of land out there. Let's see, where is it? Yes, Mejorada del Campo. Which is quite a trek out if you want to go and see it, but it's worth it because he got builders to donate him spare materials, building materials, and
Yeah,
he
like
made.
trash is not possibly the best description of this cathedral. It's made from like scraps from other construction sites.
Is, but it's absolutely beautiful. So he would use sort of plastic buckets and put them together with concrete. It sounds awful, but they would be like supporting pillars. And they were thinking it was going to be knocked down after he died because there was never any planning permission. It's enormous. It's incredible. He's had help, but it's incredible that one man has managed to do this. But yeah, they thought it was going to be knocked down and he died. And a religious organization stepped in. So, as I've been out there recently, I pitched them the story and they were very interested. And that's when I started working for Lonely Planet.
There you go. And you're doing the actual guidebook. That's a higher level of Lonely Planet than the website that I was working on.
It's just a really big project. I mean,
It
I'm
must
really.
be. Are people legitimately like buying and carrying guidebooks still?
Well, the guidebook has been completely rethought
Yeah.
because it's a we
Because
live
of
in the
Google
internet
Maps.
age. Yes. So rather than give people completely comprehensive information, the idea is you give them an insider's perspective. So we do these things called experiences where I talk about a certain aspect of the area and Again, it's a sort of similar thing to what I do in my tours. You know, I give people an insider's look into the city that's a little bit off the beaten track often. I know that's a kind of well-worn phrase we're not allowed to use.
Yeah, I remember the Lonely Planet style manual having some things that were, amusing. But yeah, one of the reasons I didn't spend more time with Lonely Planet is that I just didn't like that style of writing, and I don't want to do that style of writing. It's all it ends up, at least what I was doing, it's 100-word reviews of some restaurant, and it's got to sound like a tour guide. And I, that's not my personality at all, and I just felt stupid,
Well,
writing.
I like your blog because you inject a lot of personality into it. A lot of people are kind of afraid to write the way you do, but you sort of don't worry about courting a lot of controversy.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I do. I try to be as honest as possible, and yeah, writing, top 10 lists of tapas bars in that style is not compatible with being as honest as possible, I feel. So, also they don't pay very much over at Lonely Planet. At least they weren't paying me very much, so hopefully you're getting a much better deal than I was.
Well, you get a decent amount to write whole guidebooks.
Yeah, I would hope so. Okay.
I do like that they encourage us to be honest, because if there are things that we don't like, we're allowed to be absolutely honest about them. And I have to say, one of the things that is a bit of a bugbear for me in Madrid is the Reina Sofia, which I think is a fantastic museum, which could be 10 times better. But they don't give you floor plans telling you where any of the paintings are. They've got rid
Okay.
of paper floor plans altogether, which of course is a COVID thing. But you can download a floor plan with room numbers on, with no indication where anything is. Then you have to go to the website to check individual paintings to see where those are, but that doesn't really correspond to the floor plan that you've downloaded. So only the floor plans in the museum itself are useful, but they have to be sort of cross-referenced with information on the website. And so I was able to have a little bit of a whine about that.
Sounds like a pain.
I don't know what the philosophy behind that is. I'm sure there's some kind of there must be some kind of logic behind it, but
I don't know. I feel like there must be some sort of logic as being a bit optimistic. Sometimes these big organizations just do things, and the logic is they didn't think it through. I read an article on your blog about some of Madrid's oldest shops or Madrid's oldest stores, and some of them are in Barrio de las Letras also. I'm not saying everybody has to just hang out in Barrio de las Letras, but a few of these interesting stores that you're not going to find anywhere else. Would you like to talk about a couple of those?
It's let me just find them. I've got so much information in my brain at the moment that just trying to remember everything is quite a feat.
I've got, for example, Antigua Casa Talavera, which is a ceramic store.
That's not in Barrio de las Letras. I
Is it
found it
not?
here now. That's actually more towards Plaza de España. But I think Antigua Pastelería del Pozo probably is in Barrio de las Letras, Calle del Pozo. And that's a great place where you can get your Roscón de Reyes,
All right, and
which I'm sure you've had many of.
I've had a couple. Presumably, they do other pastries all year. I've got an article about seasonal pastries in Spain because there's a lot of things that for 1 week a year, everybody's eating it, and then you never hear about it until next year.
Oh, and
So.
there's Sesenia, which is fantastic. I my dream is to one day own a Sesenia cloak. So I think Picasso had one of their cloaks. Nick Cave has one.
Nick Cave, who's one of these British musicians who I'm supposed to know about.
Ah, no, sorry, Nick Cave. No, Nicolas Cage. Nicolas
Nicolas
Cage has.
Cage, the actor.
Although, yes, it makes more sense to think of Nick Cave swanning around in a cloak, but Nicolas Cage also likes to swan around in a cloak.
Yeah, Sesenia, this is what? Is it on? What's the name of the street? Do you remember?
Well, it's just down from it's on Calle de la Cruz, which is just down from Plaza Santa Ana.
Capa Sesenia, rumor has it that Picasso was like buried in one of these capes. I don't know the extent to which a modern person would be able to make a cape work with a reasonable outfit, but presumably there's people out there doing it. How much do they cost? Do you know?
They're very pricey. I think about 500 euros, something like that.
I remember you mentioned in the article hiding weapons beneath the capes. I think I remember one of these historical things where capes were banned because people were carrying swords under their capes and it was becoming a whole, public nuisance of guys walking around at night in capes and, stabbing people.
That's right. So it used to be that the long cape was the cape worn by working class people because it could keep you warm, if you were stuck outside all night somewhere. But Charles III tried to ban them. And he said you could only wear short capes because they were using them to conceal their weapons, as he said. And mugging was a really big problem in Madrid. Sadly, it's becoming a problem again. It's we haven't had a problem for years, and now this is gradually emerging in certain places. I don't know how Barcelona is, but
Like mugging, where like with violence or the threat of violence?
yeah, so pickpocketing has always been a massive problem. But violent mugging was never really a thing, but there are particular hot spots that have just emerged.
Where are the
And
hot
most
spots?
around Tirso de Molina, going down to Lavapiés. If you're out there about 2, 3 in the morning and on your own drunk, you're a big target. Not that you would be, I mean.
I would like to follow up with the comment that don't walk around Lavapiés at 2 or 3 in the morning alone and drunk. Any number of things could happen, and just don't do that to yourself. Yeah, that doesn't surprise me too much. It's impressive that you know all this stuff about the kings, because like every time you mention the name of one of these kings, I have to admit that when you said that history is told from the point of view of the kings, I have never thought about Spanish kings in any serious way. Like I know they existed. You say Ferdinand the Seventh. I have no further information about when that might have been or why I should care even. Why should someone care about the kings?
I mean,
Presumably.
it's just interesting, isn't it? It's Ferdinand the Seventh was so insanely corrupt. In fact, my piece on Ferdinand the Seventh is the most popular one I have on my blog, but it's mainly because, as well as being really corrupt and a terrible ruler, very oppressive, he had an enormous penis. And
Ferdinand the Seventh's enormous penis might be the headline for this podcast.
People, of course, are fascinated by that, but in his day, that was seen as monstrous and not an asset at all in any way. He had to have a special cushion to make love to his wife because the entire thing was too much.
And this is on your blog. I must have missed this when I was
It
perusing
is,
the
it
other day.
is.
Ferdinand the Seventh's enormous penis. Is he the one with like the weird big chin?
No, well, he's a Bourbon, so they were the kings who came after the Habsburgs.
The Habsburgs are the ones who started looking real funny in all of the portraits in the Prado Museum.
Exactly, because they interbred all the time.
Yes.
So Philip IV married his niece, and their son was the last Habsburg, and the jaw was so pronounced that he could barely eat. He was just.
Yeah, what was his name?
He was Charles II.
Carlos Segundo. Okay.
Yes.
Yeah. I know some of the names, and I know some of them, at least the name is associated with something that's still happening out there. There's a Universidad Carlos Tercero and all of this, but I don't know. Kings have never been something that's interesting to me, so I've never paid much attention.
Well, I would say that if you're interested, if you only have a passing interest, Ferdinand the Seventh was the bad guy, he's the villain. Charles the Third is amazing. He was an enlightened ruler and he did a lot for Spain.
Cool. Pardon
those are
my
both
noisy back there.
interesting rulers, I think.
Okay, I'll take a look. We mentioned Hemingway, we mentioned the Civil War. Are there any other interesting spots for Civil War history in Madrid?
Yes, there are, but a lot of the damage done in the Civil War was very quickly repaired. And churches, for instance, a lot of churches have been attacked by anarchists and people on the radical left because they felt that the church was really complicit with Franco. And so he had all these churches rebuilt. But there's Escuelas Pías in Lavapiés. Have you ever seen it?
Yeah, that's the big, burnt out church building. It's
Yeah.
kind of got like a library or something inside of it.
Yeah, so people are a bit bemused as to why that was the only church, burnt out church that he left. He didn't have it demolished or rebuilt. And then now, of course, it's a beautiful library because it's run by UNED, the sort of adult education university. Well, of course, all universities are adult education, so it's distance learning
Yeah.
university.
Cool. And do we know why he didn't have it knocked down or rebuilt?
There's some theories about it that Lavapiés was the very, very staunchly radicalized working class district, and there's also the only fountain with the name of the Second Republic on it in Lavapiés. A lot of the people who lived there were carted off to jail, and the area was really sort of abandoned. So maybe, and it fell into a lot of disrepair. You know, now it's all being tarted up with gentrification and everything, but during Franco's rule, it was a mess. So perhaps he wanted to abandon the area in some ways. It's really difficult to know. There's no.
Okay. The bunkers out in Parque del Oeste are one of the Civil War things that I know are still out there if somebody wanted to see them. Have you been out there?
Yes, I have. And I wrote like a walking tour for people who are interested in Civil War for the guide. The way that the conflict played out is quite interesting for people who are interested in strategy. So if you go to the Temple of Debod, you can see out to Casa de Campo. And that's where Franco's troops, they could only approach the city from the south. They got pushed back in Uceda and Carabanchel, again, very working class districts. He could manage to get through to Casa de Campo, but from the north, the Sierra de Guadarrama stopped all the troops. So that's where From Whom the Bell Tolls is all about that, the fight out in the north. But it was a natural barrier that stopped the troops coming through. From Casa de Campo, it was really difficult for them to take the city. So the siege of Madrid lasted 2.5 years because you can see from Temple of Debod, they would have to go down to the river, cross the river, which was a huge guarded front line, then go up through Parque del Oeste. If you're fighting a battle uphill, you're at a massive disadvantage. they got to Ciudad Universitaria, and there was a huge pitch battle there. And the buildings are covered, sprayed with bullet holes, and they were left. Again, no one knows why. The bullet holes were not filled in, so you can really get a clear picture of this pitched battle that went on there. And then there was a sort of stalemate for a really long time, until they finally marched into the Arco de Victoria. Do you know that in Moncloa?
I do. And yeah, nobody points out the significance of Arco de la Victoria, when you move to Madrid. Nobody's like, oh yeah, this is our big fascist thing. So I found out a lot later. I just thought it was a cool, arch monument to whatever. And Paris they've got the Arc de Triomphe, which is a monument to whatever it is, and here in Barcelona we have a similar Arc de Triomphe, which is actually a monument to nothing. They just wanted to build an arch. In Madrid, the arch is very specific. Maybe you could tell us about it.
Yeah, so it was built in the 50s to celebrate Franco's triumph, and it's since become a bit of an embarrassment. So it was neglected for a really long time. It's on the traffic island. There's broken glass everywhere. But it's an interesting structure because inside there are lifts in either side. And I just heard that the Ayuntamiento use it as a storage space for all the things they don't know what to do with. So
Really?
I'd love to get in there and find out what they've got.
That is interesting. Yeah, there's a inscription in Latin on one side of it that says something about the victory of reason, I believe. And I didn't have any idea, but I found out several years into my Madrid experience that that was actually sort of a fascist thing. Not sort of, it was actually, totally celebrating
Yes.
Franco's march into Madrid. The Civil
There's.
War is such a, big topic that I've covered a little bit on the blog, but every time I get into it, I'm like, oh God, I gotta write another 10 articles.
It's enormous, and I think it's a very painful topic.
Yeah.
Maybe it's, I don't know how you feel about this. I think it's becoming, Spaniards are becoming more open to talking about it. Possibly because that generation has died mostly. I mean, I met a 90-year-old man who remembered his entire village being bombed out during the Battle of Jarama. But apart from that, I've never really come into contact with people who lived it.
Yeah, the generation, I guess there's plenty of people now who are going to remember something about the post-guerra, but even less and less. I don't know. My contact with authentic Spanish people is a bit limited up here. The Catalans, of course, have a whole different thing that they would talk about if they were talking about the Civil War, because they didn't. I always imagined that Barcelona did the same thing as Madrid, where they like kind of fought it out for 3 years. They did nothing of the kind, apparently. Barcelona just had leftist infighting and didn't actually have to defend against the fascists at any point. So it's a different story up here. At the same time, they were doing like a social revolution in Catalonia. They had a huge anarchist population, and they were just like, let's redistribute the land and create a socialist utopia, and somehow that will win the war. The movie by Ken Loach, Tierra y Libertad, is sort of about that conflict, I believe, between, are we gonna create the workers' utopia now, or are we gonna, actually organize a professional army and try to win this thing.
There was infighting in Madrid as well towards the end. The
Was there?
Communist Party very much got in chart in power,
That's what
directed by
happened.
Russia.
Yeah, that's what happened here too. Orwell's book talks about it, and the first time I read it, I didn't quite get it. But yeah, the Soviets just kind of took over, and it ended up being pretty ugly.
Yeah, so this is why Baret initially had a fight with Hemingway, because a guy working on his team had been accused by the Soviets of being a nationalist spy. He wasn't, but he just wasn't in line with their ideology. And
Yeah.
so Hemingway was okay with him being shot. John Dos Passos, his friend, was not, and they had a huge fight about it. But then again, Hemingway later, Arturo Barea had to flee Madrid because his wife, Ilsa, the woman who translated the book, she was accused of being a Trotskyist. And Hemingway was one of the few people who defended her. And so their relationship sort of got better towards the end because he was like, well, he did stand up for his principles and talk to them. But he was also saying, you've got to get out of Madrid because she might disappear at any moment. So they were forced to flee in the end.
Yeah, 1937 was the last, I don't know, I don't want to say the last. 1937 was sort of the year of Stalin versus Trotsky. This came up in an article I wrote about the Russian Revolution because over on the Revolutions podcast, he does 130 episodes or something about the Russian Revolution. The last one he mentions, 1937, Stalin versus Trotsky. And I'm like, oh, that's exactly what Orwell was talking about. And presumably that, yeah, had a big impact all over Spain during the Civil War. It really kind of ruins my idea of the good guys versus the bad guys in the Civil War.
Oh no, the Republicans could be just as brutal as the nationalists. There were atrocities committed on both sides. And the left did not get their act together. There was way too much infighting. Of course, they had much worse weaponry. They were totally outgunned because Hitler came and Mussolini came in to support Franco from the air.
Yeah, it was a whole depressing situation, I guess. Further articles coming on my blog soon. I've got a list of, sort of things that I find surprising about the Spanish Civil War, kind of things that if you just get the very brief version of the story, they leave out all of the nuance. So, a few interesting nuances to the situation coming soon. It'll probably be up in a week or so. I'm sure you've got something else on your blog. Any greatest hits there about Civil War stuff?
I think I wrote a piece a while ago that I'd like to update again soon because I've been writing a lot about it lately. Is there's a piece about walking the front line, and that sort of gives you an idea of what I was talking about earlier, the topography of the siege and the things that you can go and see, that's still there to this day.
Yeah, I liked your article about Cerro de los Ángeles. I would love to take a bike ride down there next time I'm in Madrid, but that's a thing that I had just driven past that with some friends, and my friend kind of points out the window and he's like, that's the, geographical center of Spain. And I had no idea that there was a further story, but you tell it on the blog. Cerro de los Ángeles. Cerro with a double R is a, I guess, a hill. Basically.
Yes. Yeah, there was a bloody conflict there that was pretty hair-raising.
Hair
This is the
raising.
trouble, is I can't concentrate on the Civil War too much because I begin to feel really depressed.
Well, we can move on from that topic with an excellent segue about newer things happening in Madrid. What are some of your favorite newer developments, new places, new trends? I don't know, whatever you want.
Well, new and old, the Montaña Artificial just got reopened in Retiro. Have you ever been there?
I am familiar with it. I don't know what the deal is. I saw that you had an article about it.
Yeah, it was a capriccio. which is like a caprice of Ferdinand the Seventh. It
Is
was
this
a
Ferdinand the Seventh? I believe I remember that the caprichos were like things that he would sleep with his extramarital affairs in around Retiro Park, right?
a sort of construction that's a caprice. So building these
I had the
artificial
impression they had like the function of him being able to sneak around and.
No. One of them's just where he would go fishing. There's a little fishing hut in the middle of a lake, and right by it is an artificial mountain, and it's hollow in the middle and made of brick. And it's just quite an amazing architectural feat. But the problem is they had fountains going down the sides of it, so it was closed for years and years because of damp problems. But they've sorted that out and it's open for exhibitions. And I think it's like, even though it's opened and there's a bit of a buzz about it, not a lot of people might end up going there because it's in a sort of hidden corner of the park. So if you want to see something surprising and interesting in Retiro Park, I recommend that.
All right. What else you
In
got?
terms of interesting things going on in the city, I would say that my barrio and the barrio of Carabanchel nearby are becoming really, really great for art. So if you're interested in modern art, it's fantastic.
Are you still down in Nusera?
So we now have, both barrios have a annual open studio festival where you can go in and see the artists' studios and see what they're doing. And lots of artists have kind of bought studios in the area because it was quite industrial in the past. So you have old printmakers, places like that. And in Carabanchel, there's a new gallery called Veta, which was an old printmaker's. And the stuff they put on there is incredible. But it's all very spread out, so there's not sort of a hub of it. It's, you know,
Yeah.
different.
I mean, Nusera is a big area. I remember actually Lonely Planet, my boss at Lonely Planet 7 years ago read some article about Nusera being an up-and-coming neighborhood. And he sent me down to check it out, and I wrote back saying it is not up and it is not coming. It is exactly the same Nusera as it always was. I may have missed something, but it was. I mean, it had all the Chinese stuff. My favorite Chinese restaurant used to be in Nusera. Now it's right behind Plaza España. They moved up to the
Is it
center.
the Sichuan place?
Yeah, I love
Oh,
that
so
place.
good, yeah.
Yeah, I
We
used to
were
go
so
there.
annoyed when they closed down in
Oh
Lucetta.
yeah, because okay, you would have lived there. So I used to go. Like take a Cabify all the way down to Usera to eat Sichuan cuisine down there. They had like three tables. It had never occurred to them to take reservations at this place. Like I used to ask for reservations because I would go multiple times if I was in Madrid for 4 days or whatever. I would go, three times to the same restaurant. Finally, they moved up to Plaza España. They still remember me and my wife from being, some of the original Usera people who have been following them for years. But yeah, that place is great. I'm a big
yeah,
fan.
we went over Christmas to the Plaza España one and pigged out. We ate far more than we should have,
It's
but it
called Sichuan Kitchen or something, right?
Yeah, because in Lucetta it was called Sabor Sichuan.
Yeah. Is and yeah, it's right behind Plaza España, the big Riu Hotel on Plaza España, which is another new thing, I guess. Has the Zara downstairs, which is the world's biggest Zara or whatever it is, and then behind that is excellent Sichuan cuisine, which you should check out.
Yes, for sure.
Anything else?
Let me see.
Up and coming neighborhoods. We've got Carabanchel and Nusera, which you promise are actually up and coming now.
Well, I would say that the thing about this up and coming neighborhoods thing, I feel a little bit reluctant to push because we have a big problem with gentrification in Madrid, and there is this sort of tendency for people to talk about, you'll have an article come out with a lot of press about this neighborhood's up and coming. And I'm absolutely sure there's property developers behind that sponsoring these kind of pieces, so then they can swoop in and buy up a lot of property that then its value gets very inflated. It's a real flashpoint in Lavapiés at the moment. There's a vulture fund that's just bought out a building in Trubulete, and they're fiercely opposing the building being taken over, but it's a pretty much a done deal. So, but then again, I think Carabanchel and Nocera are quite big, so trying to create something like that is a little bit difficult here.
Yeah, Lavapiés is not that big. I mean, they've been talking about gentrification Lavapiés for as long as I've been in Spain, and as far as I can tell, Lavapiés is the same vibe as it ever was. Not the same, but it's still Lavapiés. It hasn't become, overly touristic or I don't know, Disneyland sort of
Well,
attraction.
there's some conspiracy theories saying that what we were talking about earlier with the muggings in Tissot is connected with this push to gentrify that some people are saying, and I don't know how far I believe this, that the police are turning a blind eye to these narco pisos, the places where drugs are trafficked. And not really clamping down on that stuff because these frighten away the neighbors that have always been there, and then thus the vulture funds find it easier to come in and buy up property. It is certainly true that that is the big change I've seen in Lavapiés, is that it feels less safe than it used to.
Okay. Yeah, I'm not out at 2 in the morning. I think, I'm from just the middle of the desert, so I think the first time anyone ever tried to sell me drugs was on Plaza Lavapiés. So, for me, it's always been like that was the vibe, and Lavapiés is that kind of thing. But yeah, it's got a.
I
I
think it's
guess.
hard. Sorry,
No,
it's harder
continue.
drugs that are now coming in that are
Are
sort
there?
of making people quite desperate,
Okay. What about the big squat at the bottom end of Embajadores? Is that still happening? Or I guess at the top of
Oh,
Embajadores?
well, not many people know, but that was never a squat. It's Tabacalera, which was founded by Charles III as a place to produce
Old,
spirits.
yes,
It's a
old,
really old
old
building.
spirits.
It's 18th century. And then Napoleon turned it into a place where cigarettes were made. So it was a cigarette factory for years. And then when it sort of, the cigarettes were no longer made there. It was empty for a really long time, and the government took over part of it, but they allowed a neighborhood association to run another part of it. But it fell into so much disrepair that it's now been closed down and they're doing major works on it. But there was a problem, from what I've heard. Again, this is all rumor, but the neighborhood association were having difficulties because the have you been into the basement? It's like a warren of little
I went
rooms.
through there several years ago at one point, and they were, I don't know, graffitiing the inside of the building, and it was, disrepair. But that's kind of the vibe for.
Yeah, but there were drug dealers using the basement as a way place to do deals, and then it became quite dangerous, and so the neighborhood association running it were kind of reluctant to continue doing this work for the community because there were lots of fun events on. Like, I used to go to the wrestling, that was like the best day out in Madrid.
Wow.
wrestling in Tabacalera. But
Cool. So, any other new and interesting things people should keep an eye on?
there's the Galería de Colecciones Reales. Sorry, everything I mentioned is very historical, but it's a new gallery that was opened last year. I got to go in and do a sneak peek because I was writing a piece for Lonely Planet about it. But it's now fully opened, and they have items from the collection of Patrimonio Nacional that anyone can go and see, like amazing tapestries, a Velázquez, a Caravaggio. The building itself is incredible because it drops off a cliff, quite literally, like just outside the Almudena Cathedral.
Yeah, this is what I'm imagining. So sort of right behind the palace and the cathedral, there's a new museum or gallery.
But it's enormous. Like you, even if you're not interested in the history, if you like architecture, go in and take a look because the building is stunning, and it goes all the way down to the Campo Nemoro and opens out into there.
Oh, wow. Okay. Check that out. Well, Felicity, thank you very much for being on the podcast. Thank you for sharing your unique vision of Madrid with all of our listeners out there. Remind us the title of your book and where people can get a copy.
Right, so at the moment it's only available in stores in Madrid, in Secret Kingdom's bookshop, but it's also getting distribution through La Libreria, so it'll be available in places like Fnac and Corte Inglés as well. And it's called A Guide to Madrid's Literary District. And here it is. Oh, and we've got an in-store event, I should say, about that.
Oh yeah, please.
So come to Secret Kingdom's bookshop on April the 20th at 8 p.m.
April 20th, 2024, in case anybody's listening this 7 years from now.
Yes. The great thing about book events there is there's always lots of free wine and nibbles.
All
And
right. Secret Kingdoms is where now?
it's in on Calle Moratín in Barrio de las Letras.
Cool.
So I'll be presenting the book then.
All right. Otherwise, we've got the Making of Madrid blog for a lot of interesting information about, Madrid's off the beaten track sights and sounds, etc. Anything else you'd like to mention? Famous last words?
No, I think that's it at the moment. Well,
Okay.
look out for the Lonely Planet guide, but that's coming out in 2025.
2025 New Lonely Planet Madrid Guide. And your
Yes.
name is going to be on the front cover and
In
everything, or?
lights, yes. Well, I should say I'm working with two other writers who helped out with the other barrios, but I'm the lead writer on it.
Great. Is it anybody I know?
Vesna and Natalia. Let me just—I don't have their second names here. I should mention them: Vesna Marik and Natalia Diaz.
Oh yeah, okay. There we go. Cool. Well, thank you very much for being on, and I don't know. Thank you everyone for listening, and we'll be back with more Spain to go soon.
Thanks very much. Bye.
Bye.